a 23-year-old Michigan State University graduate, is a contender for the top prize in the world of poker. Reese the Beast, that would be Ryan Reese of Waterford Township, prevailed last night in competition in Las Vegas, and that means that he competes in the World Series of Poker Championship tonight in Las Vegas. Now, Reese, or the other finalist, Jay Farber, whoever wins, takes home $8.3 million. 23 years old, $8.3 million. Reese the Beast would become the third Michigan native to win the top prize in poker. And that we will know the results of that here later on today. It's Current State here on WKAR. Coming up later in the program, we're going to learn about the soaring demand, the soaring appetite for hard cider, and how that is benefiting one mid-Michigan apple grower. And an interesting MSU project today also is out to capture one day in the life of MSU graduates and affiliates all around the world. MSU 24360 is coming up later on in the program. Today's election day, of course, voting day, and Michigan women received the right to vote on this day, November 5th. Back in 1918, 95 years ago, Michigan was one of the earlier states to approve women's suffrage. And with us now to talk a little bit about the history is Emily Fiegel. Emily is the assistant director of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame and joins us by phone. Hi, Emily.
Hi, good morning.
Nice to have you aboard here with us. First of all, do we know where does the word suffrage come from? Do you happen to know that?
Sure. Well, it's an old word with an old origin. It's got a Latin root, and really it meant originally to lend support or to vote for someone. And actually the word appears in our 1787 U.S. Constitution.
So it goes back farther than we might believe.
Yeah, I think it has its roots maybe even in the 13th century medieval French.
Oh, wow, okay. Because, I mean, I think the word is frequently used to describe women's suffrage, women getting the right to vote, but it's actually got a much richer history than that. Now, Michigan women got the right to vote in 1918, but they began to organize quite a bit earlier than that, back in the 1870s. What got Michigan started down that path?
Well, Michigan was very active in the abolition movement, the movement to end slavery. And I think the women working alongside men to end slavery, they started to naturally question their own position in society. And they were learning to organize, too, at the time. So we actually have an account much earlier of a woman by the name of Ernestine Rose in 1846. Coming to Michigan. She was from New York. She was a social reformer, and she spoke before our legislature, giving really the first public call for women's suffrage in Michigan. And that's 2 years before the Seneca Falls Convention, the first national women's rights convention. So Michigan has a really rich and early proud history of working for women's suffrage, and it just sort of stemmed out of their interest in abolition.
Now, some women came up with really innovative ways to pressure lawmakers on this issue. Tell us about the pressure system one woman came up with.
Yes, this is one of my favorite stories. Lucia Voorhees Grimes, she was a suffragist from Detroit. She actually created this card catalog system. If you remember the card catalogs that we used to have in libraries, she created a similar system for every member of the Michigan legislature. It recorded their views on suffrage. It also recorded anecdotal information about, you know, did they have a wife or children or daughters, that sort of thing. And women would use these cards when they went to the legislature to lobby. So they'd have sort of this playbook, if you will, of this person's views. And so this system was so effective in Michigan, it really impressed a woman by the name of Alice Paul, who was a leader of the National Women's Party. That was a much more militant, almost, if you will, suffrage group. They're the ones that protested in front of the White House with the banners. So she invited Lucia to come to Washington, D.C. to create the same card catalog system for all of the members of the U.S. Congress. And she did, and she went with her 5-year-old daughter, Emily, and we have a fantastic picture of little Emily holding her posters in favor of women's suffrage, probably being one of the youngest little suffragists in D.C. But this system eventually was called the pressure system, and it was a very effective tool for those suffragists lobbying Congress.
Emily, are any of these Michigan women acknowledged at the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame?
Quite a few are. We have, in the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame, we have several suffragists, many really impressive women with some really amazing stories.
Talk to us a little bit about the relationship between women's suffrage and the temperance movement. You referred to the abolitionist movement, but there's also a connection to the temperance movement, and apparently liquor interests opposed women getting the vote.
They did. There was a major social fear that if women got the vote, they would immediately pass prohibition or limiting alcohol. And alcoholism was a really big problem at the time. I don't think people today understand that. It was more readily available than clean drinking water, for example. And so alcoholism was a major problem, and women had no protections, legal protections, really, from an abusive spouse or something like that fueled by liquor. And so the liquor interest started funding the opposition groups. There's actually a group called the Michigan Association Opposed for the Further Extension of Suffrage, which is a mouthful, but it was both men and women and funded by liquor interests trying to keep women from voting. What I think is most ironic is the 18th Amendment prohibiting the sale of alcohol was actually passed and ratified well before women were voting. So men did that all on their own.
So in November 1918, voters approved a suffrage law here in Michigan. Now, national approval was not until 1920. How did that unfold? What in those couple of years there between the two, what could Michigan women vote on and not vote on? Is that clear?
So the law was passed in November 1918, granting women the vote. It was universal suffrage for women in Michigan. However, there wasn't a federal election until November of 1920. So women were able to vote March 1919 for the first time for statewide offices. The first presidential election, for example, was in 1920. So that sort of explains what women could vote at the time, but Michigan's suffrage story in general is one of sort of incremental gains. First, women were voting. Taxpayers could vote for school trustees. Then suffrage was extended to parents with school-age children. Later, you know, they gained municipal suffrage. So it was really this incremental stepping up. And so that last piece is just so fitting with the rest of Michigan's story. First, they got to vote in statewide offices, and then finally, 1920, they, with all the other women in America, were able to vote for federal offices and the president.
We're talking with Emily Fiegeld, who is the Assistant Director of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame, here about women's suffrage, which Michigan women received 95 years ago today. And is women's suffrage a particular interest to you? You're awfully knowledgeable about this, Emily.
Well, we did create an exhibit for the 75th anniversary of women's suffrage, national women's suffrage, a few years ago. And so that was a great time to sort of re-dig through all of our rich Michigan suffrage history. And it is. It's just such a fascinating story. And Michigan played a really important role. One of the things I'm particularly proud of is that we were one of the first three states all on the same day to ratify the 19th Amendment granting women's suffrage. And I think that's something we could all be very proud of.
Very good. Emily, very interesting topic. We appreciate you joining us. Emily Fiegeld is the Assistant Director of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Thank you.
Thank you.
Voters are going to the polls in 77 of Michigan's 83 counties today. Most are casting ballots for local mayoral and city council candidates, as well as school-related issues. During nearly every election, city and county clerks face a similar challenge, finding enough volunteers to work the polls. Then there's election fatigue. That term is usually associated with volunteers and voters who have grown tired of multiple ballot cycles. Today's vote is the fourth election held this year here in Ingham County. Joining us to talk about Election Day logistics, Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram. Barb, nice to talk to you.
Good morning. It's very nice to be on this morning. Thank you for having me.
How many volunteers do you like to have ready to go on an election day in the county?
You know, we like to have volunteers at all of our polling precincts that are having elections, and we like to have the maximum number possible. You know, last term, the Michigan legislature passed legislation to allow local clerks to go outside of their municipalities to get other volunteers because some municipalities were having such a difficult time getting volunteers and getting poll workers, quite frankly, people that are paid not much and worked very hard, actually, on Election Day. So we are seeing some more people able to work at our precincts, but it is a massive undertaking to conduct the elections in our state, and we need as many volunteers as possible.
How do you work pretty hard at recruiting them? Do you advertise? How does that work?
The municipal clerks get most of the volunteers and the poll workers. I train them and certify them to be able to work at the precincts, but the municipal clerks take it upon themselves to find those workers as well as those volunteers. And then, of course, campaigns find volunteers as well to help get out the vote and do a lot of those activities.
I'm curious. I tend to notice a lot of volunteers tend to be older people. Are you succeeding at getting younger people available for this job?
You know, I think in the past we have seen a lot of seniors that help out in elections, and I think with recent events over the past couple of years, the attacks on women's health and middle-class families, we're seeing more and more young people and more families coming out and volunteering to get out the vote, work at polls, and make sure people are engaged because I think they are seeing finally the impacts of elections and how the results of elections, the impacts they have on, you know, their families.
Now, the polls are open typically 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. That's a pretty long day. Do the volunteers work those entire 13 hours, or do you have enough of them that you can split these shifts up?
So the volunteers don't have to work the whole day, but the workers, those poll workers, must be there the entire time. And I think it's imperative for the listeners to know that if they are in line at 8 o'clock at night, they still have a right to vote. You know, my job as the county clerk really starts up around 7:30. And then, of course, 8 o'clock when the polls close, that's when my office, my county office, gets really busy. Because that's when municipal clerks are sending their election data to me. Mm-hmm. Now, in Ingham County, we have the city of East Lansing and the city of Lansing that can electronically upload those results to us. Meridian Township can also upload those results to us. The rest of the municipalities in Ingham County have to physically drive their memory packs to the office in Mason. So sometimes it takes a little while to get those results for some of those outlying municipalities.
Mm-hmm. Does that need to change? I mean, the driving the results to Mason?
You know, I do have concerns about driving the results to Mason, especially during the seasons of bad roads. I worry about some of my municipalities driving on the bad roads late at night. But right now, that's what is approved in our county and in our state. So that's how we have to operate. The larger municipalities, you know, Meridian Township, Lansing, East Lansing, they can electronically upload. But even with that, sometimes there are kinks in the system, and sometimes they have to physically drive those memory packs to me in the county to upload those results. So, you know, I look forward to technology improving our electoral process in our state, but right now that is what is approved.
Sounds like you breathe a huge sigh of relief when you finally got all of the results in your hands.
We certainly do. Once everything uploaded in the county, we are very thankful. But then that comes upon me to release those unofficial results. And my website's not where it should be yet. I've been working to improve that, the county website. So you'll see the results on the county website. You'll also see them on my personal Facebook and Twitter feeds because I want to make sure the results, although still unofficial tonight, those results are out there. those results will not be official results until the Board of Canvassers approves the results.
How many people work closely with you? How many people do you have staffing your office tonight after, say, 7:30 p.m.?
Tonight, it'll be me and two others, my chief elections officer and then another clerk that will be with me trying to get results received and then the unofficial results uploaded as soon as possible.
This will be the fourth election Ingham County's overseen in 2013. How big an issue is volunteer fatigue? How big an issue is voter fatigue, in your view?
I think voter fatigue is a big concern. I'm not sure we're going to see people come to the polls today. I think it's imperative that people come out and vote. You know, my grandmother always told me, you cannot complain if you did not vote. So I would encourage all people, all qualified registered voters, to make sure they get out and they vote and have their voice heard.
Very good. Barb Byram is the clerk of Ingham County. We've been talking about election logistics and voter and volunteer fatigue. Thank you, Barb.
Thank you so much for having me, and get out and vote.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. When people think of Michigan's economy, they typically point to the state's automobile industry or its fruitful agricultural sector. What may be overlooked is one of Michigan's greatest natural assets, water. A new report commissioned by the governor's office focuses on accelerating Michigan's water-based or blue economy. The paper's author, John Austin, is the director of the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas Foundation. John says that a blue economy is similar to a green economy.
Just as we've gotten our heads around that there are jobs in making clean energy products and in energy efficiency and retrofitting systems and in really enjoying the outdoors, which is green, there's an analogous set of jobs, new businesses, new technologies, you know, economic growth that can be driven by water. And part of what we're doing is trying to look already at how Michigan is positioned and beginning to grow economy based on our natural water assets as well as our water innovation abilities and our water research. There's lots of business opportunity on a global basis for new water technology businesses to solve problems around the world in freshwater treatment and health and conservation of water, which is a huge global opportunity and challenge. And so as the Great Lakes state, we already have natural water assets, our rivers and our 10,000 miles of shoreline on the Great Lakes that can make us a beautiful place to live and work and help grow local economies if we clean up our water and repurpose it so we can enjoy it. And all these things are part of what we call the blue economy that is really a special opportunity for Michigan.
In what ways does Michigan currently rely on water economically?
Well, there's four or five ways that water drives the economy. Some are the traditional ways. You know, we've got 65,000 jobs and billions of dollars linked to Great Lakes commerce and shipping and warehousing and things like a freshwater port at Muskegon that can traffic around the Great Lakes as an economic opportunity to send goods around the region. We've got a huge number of industries, agriculture, manufacturing, energy, that are just hugely water dependent. You know, 660,000 jobs are dependent on the industries that use a lot of water, and that's why they grew here. But those are the traditional ways, and I think what we're focused on in particular is what are the emerging economic opportunities built on water. And the first is this water is magical. It is a place definer. People want to live near water. They want to enjoy it. They want to recreate. There's lots of jobs created by recreation enjoyment of our rivers and our streams and our Great Lakes. You know, boating alone is 50,000 jobs. Coastal tourism around the Great Lakes is another 50,000 jobs every year related to birding and fishing and visiting the Great Lakes and our inland streams and waterways, too. And there's real local economic development from cleaning up historically polluted areas of concern in our harbors and sort of redeveloping along our rivers, facing, helping our communities face our rivers. Look what they're doing in Grand Rapids with the downtown development that's along the river with public access, and they're even putting the rapids back in the Grand. And every dollar you spend in sort of restoration and cleanup activities and infrastructure to allow people to get to the water and enjoy it is a $3 or $4 return on property values along rivers and along lake shores, and that's economic power. And as I indicated, you know, we have some of the great education and research institutions, MSU among them, that are centers of global research on water problem solving. You know, at MSU, for example, they're finding ways to solve third world health problems that are linked to waterborne pathogens. And centering that work in Michigan and the talent and the research dollars is another huge way water can be a source of new innovation and new technology jobs. Some estimate that the water technology sector, as the whole world needs to treat water, conserve it better, build in systems in manufacturing and agriculture that use water much more sparingly, that there's a $1 trillion market for new businesses and services around water technology. And that's an opportunity for Michigan with the firms and the innovation horsepower that we have to do that work on a global basis.
Is that the lion's share? Is cleanup and restoration really the lion's share of the emerging blue economy? Is that at the heart of it?
Well, I think there's equal measures of economic activity when you look at the benefits from economic development along waterways and riverfronts and lakefronts. As you see in the Detroit Riverfront or what they're doing in Macomb County to celebrate and redevelop their waterfront on Lake St. Clair, that's a long-term kind of economic development boon to make it an attractive place for people to live and work because they can enjoy the outdoors. There is this huge multi-billion-dollar water cleanup on a global basis, water technology conservation. Firms like Dow Chemical are in the water filtering business. Firms like Cascade Engineering and Grand Rapids are making a water cleaning product for the third world so people have drinkable water. That's an export industry, so there's billions of dollars there. And again, I don't underestimate the economic impact of being the center of research and learning. Young people in particular, they want to take courses and they want to do work in ecosystem management and environmental policy and sustainable industries. And when we've got, you know, literally tens of millions of dollars flowing to our universities and community colleges to expand environmental, sustainable freshwater treatment and engineering programs, that's a real economic driver for Michigan communities as well. So this the biggest way water has mattered is still the traditional way. It's an input to make and grow things. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing this growing set of jobs in water research, in new water technology that's about conservation and treating and cleanup, and in this sort of placemaking around our water and waterfronts as a local economic development engine. People want to live and work in places where you can have public access, where you can enjoy a stroll along the river. You know, for example, over in St. Clair, where their community, you know, here you are on beautiful Lake Huron, and Port Huron was sort of organized not facing the waterfront. And they're putting in new infrastructures, including, you know, walkways along the river and along the lake that make it a more attractive community. That's the kind of place people want to live and work. And in the long run, you know, there's only so much real estate on the water, and we've got a lot of it, and it's a tremendous economic sort of talent attraction and retention opportunity to clean up the factories and the brownfields and the things that were on the waterfronts that powered our economy for years, and really celebrate Michigan as pure Michigan, as this lifestyle, enjoying our beautiful lakes and rivers and streams.
John Austin's our guest. He's with the nonprofit Michigan Economic Developer Prima Civitas. The subject of our discussion is Michigan's blue economy. Is there a competitive dynamic in the blue economy? Can you look at it that way? Does Michigan have competition when it comes to...
Absolutely. As many communities and states around the world really are realizing that both leveraging their local water natural assets of being on the water, but this growing arena of water technology firms and innovation and business and services that's around water. So we have in the region, a place like Milwaukee that's really remaking itself and its brand as a water capital. So they are expanding their water research at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. They're expanding and supporting their 150-plus firms that are in various ways in the water sector, and they're growing that on a global basis, their products and services. You see Cleveland trying to do similar work. You see communities around the world, Amsterdam to Israel, that are water technology leaders. And Michigan has all the assets with the companies, with the universities, and with our freshwater ability to be testing, deploying new systems. A lot of what we've learned and selling already around the world, as China's trying to clean up the mess from its industrialization and India's running out of water, a lot of what we've learned that we're already selling our engineering firms and our ecosystem management firms was learned through cleaning up the Great Lakes. So we're now seeing our companies go and help China clean up and help places like India learn to use water more efficiently in production. And those are real growing opportunities that we have the ability to center that work, have that footprint, the companies, the universities lead it from Michigan, and make money around the world doing that.
How much would the development of a bluer Michigan economy be hampered by falling lake water levels?
Well, I think that principally takes away one of the more profound assets in terms of how water drives economy. The lake shores, the property is so valuable and attractive if the water's clean and it's right outside your door or your hotel or your condominium or your office. So if that water retreats hundreds and hundreds of yards and it's more like an Aral Sea situation, in Central Europe, they so overused their water resource there that it dried up the lakes. Obviously, we're nowhere near that, but you can see the economic development plus of people wanting to live, work in communities like Traverse City, where it's a lifestyle, enjoying the water, like Marquette even is being to see, like Grand Rapids, like West Michigan, East Michigan, you point everywhere. If the lake levels recede profoundly, then that's going to be a much less attractive place to have a cottage, to live in the community as a professional. So that's a big issue for us. Climate change is a big driver of that, as the ice doesn't cover the Great Lakes, and we see more evaporate. So that's part of why we need to be a leader in energy efficiency and water efficiency, so that we can be part of the world solution to things like that and do that work here and reap the jobs and benefits from doing that here.
Give us, John, one other challenge associated with developing the blue economy. We just spent on the water levels.
Right.
What's another one?
Well, I think that's what we're learning through this project and this initiative, and that's what we're trying to help the state, the Office of the Great Lakes, as they develop a water strategy. What could really the state do? What could we all do that accelerates our participation? Clearly, one challenge is just infrastructure and sort of water along the waterfronts redevelopment. We have a lot of expensive both cleanup and rebuilding to do around our waterfronts where they were slag heaps, they were old factories. That's expensive work to clean up those areas and then position them with infrastructure so that the market wants to move in and people can redevelop it, whether it's for hotels or shops or restaurants or just keeping some of it for natural enjoyment. It's got to be clean. And so the infrastructure costs, the cleanup costs, and the investment to help communities do that is probably a significant piece that does pay big dividends. We know that when we do that, you see local economic development come in that is worth a lot in terms of new jobs and new community building.
So how much economic potential is there in the blue economy? Are you close to quantifying that?
Well, the report we just did, which is really a sort of baseline for this initiative we're doing to try to accelerate our participation in the blue economy and to inform the State Office of the Great Lakes, the Governor's Office, who are developing some water strategy for Michigan, we're seeing that already we've got about $60 billion annually and close to 1 million jobs that are associated with water-based economic development and water innovation and technology jobs. And there's a huge opportunity for growth, given that estimates around the water technology business worldwide, close to $1 trillion in 10 years, and the need for water solutions in manufacturing and in the developing world. It's a tremendous upside for Michigan to center that work, and we're looking for ways we can help accelerate the participation of firms, learning institutions, and communities around this wonderful blue economy opportunity.
John Austin is the director of the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas Foundation. This Current State segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, Americans' taste for hard cider has been climbing. According to market researcher Ibis World, hard cider sales have increased an average 27.5% annually during the last 5 years. That's encouraging for Michigan's sizable community of apple growers who have over 9 million trees in production. Michael Beck is one of those growers. He's the owner of Uncle John's Cider Mill in St. John's. He began processing hard cider for sale a dozen years ago. And Mike Beck joins us now to explain a little bit more about what's going on. Hi, Michael.
Hey, good morning.
What's behind this increase in demand for hard cider?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors pushing the hard cider phenomena. One of it, I think, is people are wanting to buy local. And Michigan has over 30 of these hard cider brands in growing. And so practically every region of the state, they can find a local cider. So I think that's one of the factors. I think people are also appreciating new craft beverages. And the gluten-free movement has been also a major push. Cider gives the beer drinker that goes gluten-free an option to go with their meal or social events.
You've been at this a few years already, so take me back to 2001 or so. Why did you start offering hard cider?
Well, we were actually, we wrote a grant to the USDA to start a hard cider business, and they actually awarded us. So
were you surprised at the time?
Well, yeah, because I wrote it myself, I was going up against big companies, big brand name companies, for some of these grants.
So you were thinking outside the lines there back in 2001 with the grant.
Exactly. Yeah. And so when the government offers you a grant to do something, you can't say no. So so that really got us started. And
were you amongst the first do you know? I mean, how many other local Michigan growers were making hard cider in 2001? Do you know?
Just me and one other guy started the same year.
Okay.
J.K. Scrimpy over in Flushing.
Okay.
So we started the same years, and both of our businesses have just grown incredibly since then, and several new cideries every year have been popping up.
Has it been steady, or has it been more dramatic?
A steady increase. Three new places, the next year, or five new places the next. It keeps growing steadily upward as far as the number of brands opening up in Michigan.
And other growers have been noticing, though. I mean, when demand like this climbs, the business community tends to notice it. Are you the novelty you used to be?
I don't know about that, but we try to set ourselves apart from everyone else. We enter a lot of high-profile competitions in the cider world, and we do well at those. So we try to set ourselves apart as far as being the premier quality producer.
And big beverage companies are now in the game.
And it's encouraging because they're going to plow a huge road for us.
Have they cut into your business significantly?
Well, We've been doubling in size every year, so I can't say because I think, you know, it's a very small market when you compare it to the beer or wine or spirits market. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of room to grow.
But again, there's the buy local movement, which benefits you.
Correct.
In your view. What's the value of apples as a commodity these days? Is it relatively high? Is it about where it always is? Where is that?
It's about where it always is.
What is that?
Well, for let's say the most lowest valued apple that we grow in Michigan, maybe 8 cents a pound for them. You know, those might end up in some low quality juices and things like that. Up to, you know, I like to pay around 60 cents a pound for some regular juice fruit, and then for cider fruit, closer to, gosh, $1 a pound.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Michael Beck, who is the owner of Uncle John's Cider Mill in St. John's, about the soaring demand for hard cider, not just in Michigan, but across the country and really Europe, all over the place. You've set up a half a dozen different creations here of your hard cider on our console here today. How many different kinds, how many different vintage, do I call them vintages? I don't know. I don't know what to call them.
We'll call them cider styles. We have about a dozen. I brought six here today. And, you know, they can range from Perry, made from pears, or one cider I have is made out of russeted apple varieties. One here in the middle is made from heirloom apples. This one over here is made from more of European apples. They can vary by just the apples that we use, much like grapes. The grape styles vary by the grapes that they use.
And how much time went into refining how each of these would taste?
Well, it's a very fluid process because unlike grain, which is always the same, fruit is different from year to year, just like vintages of wine. Apples are no different. The growing conditions throughout the summer. So it's more of there's no set situation. You really have to know the fruit. And the fruit's the star of the show. Nothing I do in particular is incredible or fantastic.
Have good years and bad years, grape growers?
Well, and more like different years. One year we might have more sun and heat and less acid produces in the fruit. So a cooler year like this year creates more acid in a fruit and other flavors. So, you know, it's different from year to year. Yeah, some vintages may be a star for whatever reason, but a lot of it's about the fruit that you put in it, and it's a very fluid process.
Do you just sell locally or just in the Lansing area, or do you try to get your product further out in the state?
We have our ciders placed all over at least the Lower Peninsula, the city of Chicago, and Oregon, of all places. So
why Oregon?
There is an incredible cider movement in Oregon. And there's an incredible craft beer movement out there, too. But there's a huge craft cider movement in Oregon. Mm. And there's lots of producers out there, but we sell lots of cider out there. It's a very wide open market.
Are more Michigan growers still... Do many more Michigan growers have yet to commit to making hard cider? Do you expect the number of producers to go up?
I expect the number of producers to go up. I've talked to, there's one over on the west side of the state, east side of the state, that just opened weeks ago. I helped them along in the process, even got them some cider blends to sell for their opening event. I know of at least three more opening next year. So I expect it to keep growing. But we have an advantage here in Michigan. We have all these places that are making fresh cider for years, and they've got the fruit in the ground. So they've got practically most of the business invested already. So, you know, they've got the tools there. All they need to do is get a license from the state and the federal government, and they can start producing their own product. So... Mm. You know, they already have the tools they need to be successful cider makers.
So the transition to hard cider is really not dramatic at all.
Not dramatic
in terms
at
of
all.
Technology or processes or anything like that.
Yeah, they've already got the tools they need. They just need to buy a little yeast and get a few licenses.
Have state economic developers, has state government played a role in accelerating cider production?
Well, the university for sure has, but state government not so much. We're kind of excluded from like some of the wine programs. So,
Well, you're not considered wine though, correct? Or are you?
Well, we get wine licenses. There's no cider license, so we don't really. But we get excluded from the wine program. So.
Okay. So the growth that we're seeing in Michigan, at least, has been, it's mainly driven by the industry itself,
yep.
by growers, by individual
by
growers
are,
like you.
Yep. So the Michigan Apple Committee and Michigan State University have been all in, though. So our Apple Committee is the committee that the growers pay into to help for marketing funds and research for apples. And Michigan State University has had plantings up north for a while. And they also, the same year I got my grant, they also did some grant work as well for the technical aspects of cider making to help our growers along if they had questions about the step of fermentation. So we've at least had some assistance on that side of it to make it all happen.
You mentioned the craft beer movement has really helped fuel the demand for hard cider. Go a little bit deeper with us into that. What's the appeal of the craft movement as far as you're concerned?
Well, you know, Michigan is special. Our Great Lakes, as far as craft beer goes, they're starting to put more and more Michigan ingredients into craft beer. But, I mean, where else in the world would you rather get water from than the Great Lakes? So mm-hmm. that's the major ingredient for beer. So that's why Michigan beer is so good. We have the best water, but we also have, here in Michigan for cider, we have this infrastructure of processors. You know, we have big names here, Gerbers, Welch's, Mott's. You know, these are gigantic names. They're set up here, Sara Lee, the list goes on and on. They're here for a reason because we can grow fruit that fits the profile better of foods for cooking and processing. And they have more structure, things like Northern Spies and Jonathan's, they have structure. They don't break down when cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So in a typical year, over 60% of the harvest goes to processing anyway. So we don't grow a lot of table fruit here. We grow apples for the foods that actually people eat.
Do you sell any of your crop to food processors or manufacturers, or do you use it all for your own products?
Well, we used to, but now our value-added products that we're making, things like this, and we also, we're a distillery, we make vodka and brandy from apples. So all those things, I don't have to search for processors to sell my apples at the lowest price possible, essentially. Mm-hmm. So we are kind of have moved away from being able to have to sell to anyone else. We can just use it ourselves.
Back in 2001, when you told your other growers that you were pursuing a grant to process hard cider, what was their response?
At the time, it was a little more desperate back then, and so they were, I had to take some of our things that we were doing between the university and things to the Apple Committee Board, and they were very encouraging because we needed more markets for our fruit. So if the closer we could use those markets at home, the better. So they were very encouraging.
We're talking with Michael Beck, who is the owner of Uncle John's Cider Mill in St. John's. This has got to be, is November your busiest month or October in terms of just getting people to your location there north of St. John's?
Definitely October is the busy month for sure.
But so. November must be second, I would
no,
imagine.
No, absolutely not.
No, it's not September.
And probably even August is busier.
Okay.
So I don't know. People seem to shut off the cider switch when November comes around. So
interesting. How many acres do you have?
We have about 300 acres. About 80 of it is apples, and then we grow a lot of other crops as well, all specialty crops. So.
Your name, your last name, is really well known in St. John's, largely for the cider mill. How many are you, the second or third generation?
I'm the fifth generation.
Fifth generation apple grower.
Yeah.
At Beck's.
Yep.
So apples have been grown on that property since when?
Oh, boy. I wish I had that number handy. I didn't know I was going to get quizzed there. 1800s, late 1800s, Or maybe even sooner. I guess I'd have to get back with you on that one.
Okay. I should have forewarned you that was coming. Well, I'll tell you, this is a pretty decorative display that we've got. We could probably sell some of this stuff here. We need to bring some of the right people from the other parts of the building down to Studio S. We'll probably move some product here for you before we're through, Michael. Michael Beck is the owner of Uncle John's Cider Mill in St. John's. We've been talking hard cider. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Last year, an ambitious MSU project sent a video crew around the world to document the world grant impact of Michigan State University. It was called MSU 360. This year, things are being turned around, making Spartans everywhere members of the crew themselves. Jim Peck of MSU's Communications and Brand Strategy Office led that globe-trotting trek last year, and he's behind this year's MSU 360-24 project. He tells current state Scott Pohl that all of the footage and photos should be taken on the same day, that's tomorrow.
We know we're going to get some people that are doing amazing things. We know that we're going to get some people that are just doing regular things. And that's fine. You know, it's not going to be the same kind of project that 360 was, that there will be no voiceover, there will be no graphics. My hope is that people start watching this when it's all done, and it kind of flows over them, that they get a real feel for what the world looks like through the eyes of Spartans. And, you know, I know we're going to get a lot of regular stuff and people doing the video versions of selfies and all that wonderful stuff that you can see any day on Facebook. But we hope that we're getting the stuff that people are doing out there that make a difference in the world, that make a positive difference. And I think that it's going to be really fascinating. And it's a little weird for me as a producer to be putting the production in the hands of all of these random people. But you random people who are out there listening to me, please do your best and be part of the crew. And please help me out. We need some good stuff from this.
Now, we're talking about Wednesday, November 6th.
Yep, from midnight to midnight. So it's midnight Wednesday, so that's going to feel like really late at night Tuesday, all the way to overnight on Wednesday night. And this is going to be one day around the clock, around the world. So when we put this together, you will see the sunrise in Australia, in East Lansing, in Los Angeles, in the Philippines, wherever these people send it in. And then we will go through the day that way. So it will be seeing one day, one single day, throughout the world, through everybody's eyes and throughout their cameras. And what's cool about this is these days, everybody has camera phones. You know, most people, everybody has some version of a video camera. It's not like if we had tried to do this only 3 years ago, it would have been really difficult and people would have had to go and get some kind of camera. Now it's in your hands. I mean, it's there all the time.
For the sake of clarity, midnight to midnight local time?
Their local time. So, yeah. So, wherever you are, it is midnight Wednesday to 11:59 Wednesday. This is one single day. And I think that's what makes it really cool.
What don't you want people to take video of or shoot photos of for this project?
You know, other than the obvious things that are going to be, offensive or disagreeable, and folks, we will just edit those out. So you feel free to send, but we'll knock them out in the editing suite. You know, there's really nothing I don't want people to send. I mean, I think that it's more a notion of, you know, you cover your day the way you're living it, and then we will put this together in a way that we think makes sense. But the only kind of story that we're applying to this is the clock. You know, this is we rarely do things that are truly chronological because we try to usually impose some kind of storytelling on these or, you know, fit it into a certain theme. And this theme really is just one day. So the ebb and flow of what happens will happen as everyone's day follows the clock.
You want people who have an MSU connection, graduated from the university, work for MSU, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, we spread the net of what a Spartan is pretty widely. And, you know, we include people who went here, people who work here, people who go here now. You know, we've got students that are going to be, I know that we're going to be having shooting around campus because they're already writing to me. I spent most of the weekend writing back to people saying, yes, shoot this. They said, like, you want me to shoot my lunch? Yes, shoot your lunch because we need to have everybody having lunch. Take a picture of a clock so we know what time it is. Take a picture of what it looks like where you are at that moment and try to let us know where you are. I mean, it doesn't all have to be street signs and cities and towns, but it would be great that if somebody is in, you know, Zambia, that it looks like Zambia. That if you're in Los Angeles, it looks like Los Angeles. If you're in Seattle, of course, it's raining.
Finally, how do people submit material?
There's a great website up right now that they can go to, which is msu.edu/24, just 24. There are some descriptive things up there right now. We will have a download page where you can follow the directions. It's going to be very simple. Basically, you just plug your device into your computer. There's a way to click it, to download, to upload it, and just to fill out a couple of fields just to let us know where it's coming from and some really basic information. We're trying to make it as simple as possible so that you don't have a lot of hoops to jump through.
Jim Peck of MSU's Communications and Brand Strategy Office. Thank you and good luck with the project.
Thank you very much. We're depending on you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we will recap today's election results, also a preview of the East Lansing Film Festival. All that and more coming up Wednesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. Polls are open till 8 o'clock. Don't forget, don't let that slip through the cracks today. Remember to vote. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.